questions about notice after the Monday night offerings, and you've had a day to dissect what was a big round of footy there. So actually, probably the one that has come that we haven't spoken about is the Jack Viney situation. So didn't see that on the day. He had a altercation with, I think it was Sam Collins.
Sam Collins, yeah.
And got into a wrestle and a fracas. Now he had his what looked to be his forearm on around the face and throat of Collins, which wasn't a great look. So he's been sent straight to the tribunal for misconduct. So he's got to now front up and explain himself.
Completely unacceptable. Completely unacceptable non-football act that Jack committed on the football field. And it looked violent. It looked ugly. It looked potentially seriously dangerous as well. And I think they've done the right thing by sending it to the tribunal. Now, we don't know what sort of a penalty they may come back with, but I wouldn't be surprised if he got at least 2 weeks for that.
Yeah, look, it's difficult. And I've got to call it as I see it. I agree. I hated the look. I love the man.
Well, you tell
I hated
me,
the look.
You told me exactly what you thought when you saw that.
Oh, no, that's, you know, we know.
No, but it took your mind to a violent act that had occurred over.
Yeah, and ended up in a
in the death
situation
of somebody over in America. Yeah,
yeah, so, yeah, I didn't like it. And I know Jack's a smart kid. He'll look at it. I hope he'll look at it and go, yeah, in the end. Because it was, okay, if it's there for half a second as you're pushing yourself up, well, you can kind of, but it was there for a prolonged period of time. So, yep, we will wait and see. I think it's got multiple weeks as well.
You think two? Do you think two will cut it off or not?
At least.
Yeah.
I think they'll make a point of, and it's fair enough, they'll make a point and say this is not the look we want in footy.
No, there are things that you can reasonably expect to have happen to you on the football field. And what took place there is not one of those. Yeah. It's just not one of those. So he will answer that at the tribunal online too. So he's over there in Perth,
he's in Perth, yep.
There'll be a link between the two.
Can I ask you one more? Oh, this is all questions that notice. A very simple one. What is your opinion of the West Coast Eagles today, their football club?
That they are just limping to the line. That's my opinion of them as a football club.
That's the most generous assessment I've heard.
Well, but I said that they were pathetic yesterday.
Their
performance yesterday was pathetic. But, yeah, when you analyse what they're doing at the moment and the fact that they haven't been able to get themselves back on track in a meaningful and consistent way, and then I looked at that vision you showed last night on the couch and the efforts of some of those players, their head just wasn't in the game. And it beggars belief that somebody like Shannon Hearn, their skipper, can be playing his 300th game. So a really meaningful occasion for somebody that you would hope that they all admire and look up to, and then that you could trot out a insipid performance like that as part of that celebration.
Why? That's what I kept trying to get to last night.
No, I heard you last night, and I think exactly the same thing. And it's never one thing. Like, we all try probably and simplify these reasons as to why teams aren't performing, and they're never one thing, but I would shake it up. And I said yesterday, and I know you talked about it last night too, the best team performance that I've seen from them came that day up at the SCG against Carlton when they had their backs to the wall with what looked like a really inexperienced, depleted side, but they had that desire to want to compete and play hard. And we've only seen that on rare occasions from them this year.
So I think, I've been trying to think about it because it doesn't annoy me, but I'm looking at it thinking, because I keep asking the question why. They must have that group of players that played on the weekend a sense of entitlement.
They're not on the edge, are they?
Yeah, there must be the sense that irrespective of what happens, because we've spoken about the fact that this has happened previously on a number of occasions, yet they're still there. And I know there's limited amount of players that you can put into a team, so I understand all that sort of stuff. But there must be a sense of comfortability about them. Over there in Perth, the big dogs in the big city, they play every week pretty much anyway. So, you know, we can have a humiliating performance when Sydney beat us down there. But you know what? Guess what? I'm going to play. I'll still play next week.
Do you shake him up?
Somehow it's got to be shaken up.
How do you shake them up, though? Do you drop a couple of big-name players and just say, look, that is an unacceptable... You could show them the vision. You could show that vision last night and say, okay, well, that's just unacceptable from you.
Yep.
you're out this week. You're not playing.
Yeah, well, I think you've only got so many mechanisms at your disposal within this. And I think that's what you got to do, Tim. You got to make that call. And then you got to make a really harsh assessment on what happens at the end of the year in terms of your playing list. Mm. I mean, we looked at the demographic of it, okay. The demographic's all right when you're winning like Geelong are, 10 of the last 11. It's not when you're losing by 90-odd points.
When you're making comparisons with teams' efforts and their situation, you always benchmark the best, okay? So let's benchmark the best in sport that we know here in this country, given what's happened with COVID-19 the last 12, 18 months. Mm. Melbourne Storm, okay? Last year, they did it harder than anybody, yep. any other team in this country. Forget about AFL football. Any other team in this country, they did it harder than anybody. Mm-hmm. Went on and won the grand final. This year, they've had it tough again because they've had to move around and go into a hub, all that sort of stuff. Still performing.
Yeah, yeah.
You go back to the West Coast Eagles when they went into that hub last year and they were performing the way they were. And what did they do?
Mm.
They fell apart as a group and an organisation. Yeah. They started to talk about how tough. Now, everybody was experiencing it tough, okay? They didn't have it any tougher than anybody else at that time. But I think it goes now, on reflection, it goes to the heart of that group of players and how they're not able to fight their way through adversity.
So that's the other thing. The Sydney Swans are the team that we lauded last night. You compare, and it just occurred to me whilst we were doing the show, you compare the two. Compare the two teams in terms of one's no-nonsense attitude, no acceptance of, you know, poor performance, no deviation in their best and worst. Yeah, you know, of course they're going to lose games, Sydney, and they had a year last year, but this is how quickly they bounce back because they've got a There's no sense of comfortability or entitlement in that side. There is the standards. You play to these or you won't be a part of the Sydney Swans. Mm. And even Geelong. Like Geelong, I know people don't want to give Geelong their credits. Geelong don't have performances like the West Coast Eagles.
They don't fluctuate like that.
One of those performances would be enough for Chris Scott and his group. And then the ramifications and the whether it's Selwood or Dangerfield eyeballing the group saying, yet this thing just keeps happening over there. So there is an undeniable issue and it needs to be fixed. And that's for them to sort out. But it's.
Well, they've had a long time to diagnose their problem.
Yeah.
Like you go all the way back to that horrendous loss against Geelong. I mean, that's a long, long time ago now.
And Sydney at Geelong.
That's right. And then they followed up with that really poor performance against Sydney and they still haven't been able to find the mechanism to correct it.
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Hey, Adam Treloar might be back for the West. You're talking about a side at the other end of the scale who are on top of the ladder and purring along at the moment. Dunkley back in the last couple of weeks. Adam Treloar now looks like he might be available this week against Essendon.
That's a tasty little in, isn't it? Like if you were wanting
a nice little morsel.
If you were wanting to give a player like he a nice little run in tune up for the finals, you'd be saying, okay, let's give him 3 weeks before the finals start. You know, that'll get him back on track and conditioned, that type of thing. So that can't come at a better time for him and their chances as well. He makes an enormous difference because he provides a point of difference about their midfielders. Mm. And we saw that early in the season when he's playing. Like, he actually has got a turn of speed. He's got some real power and some real jets to the way he plays coming out of stoppages and out of congestion. So he's going to be in a massive inclusion.
Report in the paper today that, I think it was in the paper, Cam Guthrie, best and fairest winner at the Geelong Footy Club, is a unrestricted free agent and out of contract, so that's, we can sort it out. That's fair enough. Tom Morris also reported last night that Luke Parker is an unrestricted free agent, superstar we spoke about yesterday, and out of contract. Cannot envisage any situation in how he doesn't stay at Sydney, but let's just take that aside. When you're talking about the Gold Coast Suns and what can they do, and this is... I know it can be fairyland, but this is exactly what needs to be done. Guthrie, Parker, two others, and take them up there and embed them in that place. They may may not want to do it. But if it gets to that, I mean, until such time as we can see something like that take place, they seem and appear and reportedly have invested all of their money, a lot of their money, most of their money in their young talent.
And they would say they have to, otherwise they can't keep them.
They can't keep them. So they've got that issue. That's right. But that then compromises your ability to attract the quality. So, you know, Parker will stay at Sydney, I'm sure, because that's what Sydney do, and he's a Sydney man. But if it's a money thing and they're having a big blue, just say hypothetically in the wildest they can't resolve it, Gold Coast ability to go in and go, bang, here's money that you want. Get in here.
They're exactly the type of soldiers that they need up there. Exactly the type of soldiers they need have come from. And this is the in the selection for the Gold Coast Suns is the pedigree of those players, where they come from, the type of organisation they've been associated with, the type of team they've been associated with, the type of coaching they've had. It ticks all those boxes for them.
It does, doesn't it?
Can I ask you this question about the Gold Coast Suns, though? Do you think, given the Gold Coast Suns are one of the newer teams to the competition, they're still wed to the AFL, obviously the AFL underpin them financially, do you think that if they were thinking about moving on from Stuart Dew, hypothetically, do they have that conversation with the AFL? How pivotal to the conversation is the AFL?
Yeah, no, I think they'd have to. I think the AFL would oversee.
Because they have to say paid you out first?
Oh, yeah, but all those teams that have been on a drip feed in the past, Melbourne Footy Club included, when they make big, big decisions, they have to run them past the AFL.
Okay, so we all know that Mark Evans had a relationship with Al Clarkson. They were both at Hawthorn together. Al Clarkson is now available. He's not coaching next year. Do they have that conversation, do you think, the AFL, with the Suns?
Probably. Of course they should. Of course they could ask that question and start to work through that process, because when the best is available and you've got a problem, then you can put the two together. Now, the likelihood of Alistair Clarkson doing that, I think, without having ever spoken to him, would be really slim, and I think he needs a year off. I think a year away from footy completely for him would be the best thing. But, yeah, I think any club who's in that situation would be looking at him, wouldn't they?
They would be mad not to. Mm. At this point in time, they would be mad not to have a look at him.
You can get frustrated on the Gold Coast Suns forever, but we keep remembering that they're an 11-year-old organisation.
Yep.
And if we want to go back through history and look at the clubs that have come into our AFL competition, if you want to go way, way, way back, and I know the history, you've got to be patient, I know. But right now, it's just in a situation where it needs something up there. And if it's support for Stuart Dew, then it's support for Stuart Dew. I don't know, but it just looked pretty grim on the weekend. The Kia Sorento Drive Car of the Year is great supporters of ours. We'll come back after this.
Smarter, quieter, safer. Garage doors redefined. Discover more at 4ddoors.com.au. Kogan credit cards. No annual fees, amazing rewards, and complimentary Kogan First membership.
Breakfast with Gary Lyon and Tim Watson.
Hey, welcome back to the program. Thank you. Seven Seat Careers. Keisha has been crowned Drive Car of the Year. I want to play this. This is the Arrow. I'm going to play it last night on Footy Classified. And this is Carolyn Wilson on the appointment of Nick Del Santo as the AFLW coach for St Kilda.
Another favourite son gets a senior women's coaching gig, and yet again we see the women's game being further remoulded into the shape of a man. We see it at the Olympics and we keep seeing it in footy. Male coaches turning to women's sports and too often using those sports as a pathway back into the male game. Yes, St Kilda interviewed women for the job. One even made it to the shortlist. Until the AFL promotes women's coaching pathways from the bottom to the top, the jobs for the boys will continue.
So that's on the back of Nick Del Santo being appointed. I wasn't aware that, I didn't even know that Nick was going for the job. So it got to the stage where there was a shortlist, obviously. There was Nick. According to Caroline, there was a female coach that had made it to the shortlist as well.
What's the
obligation then? Do you appoint the best coach, or do you appoint the female coach to make sure that you have a strong representation in the coaching ranks?
Well, I think you attack
strong representation. There's no representation of a female in the coaching ranks.
Okay. Just in answer to your question, do you know what the coaching pathways program is for female coaches?
No, I don't.
Is it part of? I know that there is a coaching pathway, and they do level two, three, four courses. And I know David Whedon has been part of all that too, behind the scenes at the AFL for a long period of time. Is the same system open and available to women?
I would imagine so.
Okay. But you can
do your level one and level two and all that sort of stuff.
That's right. So
yeah, I would think so.
So has the pathway been developed, which is my question to you?
Is it available to the women to or to the females to be able to be involved in the
that's
in
right
the is coaching there a, pathway?
Is, yeah, because that's the question yes. that Caro said. Is, you know, that pathway is it there?
I don't know the answer. I would say yes. I assume. I'm just assuming that if you want to be a coach and you want to enter and put yourself forward for a level one coaching course, that would be available to you.
My simple answer to that question would be that if you're the coaching panel, do you not want the best person for the job? Now, I don't know. I didn't sit down and interview any of those people, so I don't know who the best person for the job was. Has Nick Del Santo coached before?
Yes, he's been coaching there as
juniors.
The next generation academy coach. He's been coaching at the AIS for the AFL. He's been involved with their elite program and been involved with their father-son program down there at St Kilda as well.
Okay, so if I'm a player, from a player's perspective, and I'm sure there are not enough female coaches out there at the moment. I'm sure that, and I'm hopeful that in time there will be a whole bevy of women coaches that come through, say the coaching system, and then have the experience, whatever it might be, right? So, but if I'm a player, I want the best. I want the person who can produce the best team performance for me as a player to give me the best advantage to develop as a player and then ultimately experience success as a team member of that particular team that's coached by whoever it might be, male or female.
So why is there no female coaches then?
I can't answer that question. I don't know whether or not there's enough female coaches in this. I don't know. I really don't know. But my answer to your question is, okay, who is the best person?
Well, Peter Searle was the coach.
Who is the best person to deliver the best results for the individual and for the team, be it man or woman?
Do you have to have an eye to the development of the coach?
Always. Oh, I think there's always got to be
okay,
the
so
eye to
is
that.
There but is there a level of compromise there to say, okay, maybe the female candidate is not at the level of the male, but in the interest of trying to attract more women into coaching and therefore...
That should be a consideration.
That should be a consideration.
But we haven't had this elite competition for very long.
Yep.
Have we?
No. No, we have not. Travis Old has had one of the more unenviable tasks in recent times. He's executive general manager of clubs and broadcasting and trying to keep the competition going. I don't know. He's had a long and distinguished career in sports media, has Travis, but I don't know whether he would have ever had anything that could have prepared him for the last week or two. Trav, good morning.
Morning, Gaz, Tim. How are we?
Well, we're going okay. You're getting much sleep at the moment. Is this the calm before what could be a storm, or do you think you got round 21 under control?
Well, there's not a lot of calm, certainly not on the weekend. I think we've learned over the last, I don't know, what is it now, almost 18 months, that you just got to be ready for anything. And certainly Saturday was that when I woke up. I wasn't expecting to have the Saturday that we all had. But when we found out that we needed to make some decisions, make them quickly, we got everyone on board and rather get those teams out of Queensland and keep the competition moving.
Good morning, Travis. Rugby stayed. They had no other option. Did you contemplate that staying and negotiating with the government, or was that sort of closed off pretty early and pretty quickly for you?
For us, it was a bit different, Tim, just simply because we don't have our entire competition there. And so if you look at the next couple of rounds, or certainly look at this coming round, each of those teams play in Melbourne anyway. And so had we left them there and been able to get those games away, we would have found ourselves in a difficult position this week. So it was the right decision to get them out. You certainly look at all options at the time and try and make the best decision you can.
How difficult has it actually been in a sense of the complexities that surround all this, the decision making that's taking place almost hour by hour, and how closely are you linked to the governments in each state?
Yeah, I think the real difficulty, Tim, is that the number of people that are impacted when you make these decisions. So the most obvious ones are the clubs and the players themselves, but it goes right through to our umpiring group, our match day officials, broadcasters, venues, people that work at venues. You look at the weekend just gone, there's a couple of games in Melbourne that weren't expected to be played. They need to be staffed. Broadcasters need to prepare. So there's a lot of knock-on impacts that you don't think about at the time. To your question in terms of governments, we've been very fortunate. The last 18 months has only sort of strengthened our relationship with each of the state governments. We rely heavily on their advice. We work closely with them in terms of how we best manage the environment at the time, and they've been incredibly supportive.
We've read, and I don't know how accurate this is, but we've read the rugby is looking potentially at the MCG. At this stage, the AFL has no idea as to which weekend the AFL Grand Final might be played due to, obviously, COVID and it flaring up somewhere in the country and maybe here in Victoria, whatever it might be. How many weekends do you have the MCG on standby for?
Oh, look, I think there's two parts to that. One is that we've got the flexibility created by the weekend off, obviously between the home and away in the final series. And we did think about for a moment on the weekend, do we use that if we can't get the round away? But it's really for us, it's a safeguard that if we need an extra time in order to play some matches we haven't been able to get away or even bring forward the final series, if that's the right way to do it, then that's there as an option, which gives us a good chance to get that game, the final game played last Saturday in September. So we can push back if we need to. We've got a very good relationship with the MCG. But at the moment, our intention is to get the grand final played that last Saturday in September.
Is there a possibility that we could actually see the AFL grand final played at the MCG on a Saturday and then the NRL grand final played on a Sunday at the MCG?
Oh, from my point of view, I couldn't see why not. It depends on what the conditions are at the time in terms of crowds and all the things that sit around that. But that's more of a question, I think, for the MCG than it is for us.
Trev, have we got contingencies in place? There was Bruce Keeber and others. Eddie McGuire spoke about, you know, the lockdown of the precinct and, you know, testing on a Wednesday and then a quick test on actually the ground. I mean, what sort of contingencies have you got in place?
Well, yeah, Gary, that's a bit of a focus at the moment is what's the, you know, once again being led by government, what's the best chance we've got of maximising a crowd for the grand final? And I think it's particularly relevant at the moment when you've got so many, the top of the ladder's occupied mainly by Victorian teams, and so there's going to be a big push for crowds as there always is with the grand final, and so we're looking at every option, but once again it's something that'd be led by government and by the experts.
But is there any chance that something like that, a lockdown of the precinct, could come into play?
Yeah, I think so. I think we could look at all those options. I mean, one thing we've done this year is increase the number of requirements that exist around a game in terms of scanning and so forth to provide a safe environment for attendees. And so anything we can do that makes people feel more comfortable going to football, we're certainly willing to explore.
Now, we're alerted to the fact that Melbourne and Brisbane are sharing, is that right, the facility over there in Perth? So it's like, is it 3 days each or 3.5 days each that they get to spend at that facility? How's that all work?
Yeah, the requirement playing games in Western Australia is the teams need to do 7 days hotel quarantine. There's two facilities. One's got a bit more space than the other. And so we thought it'd be fair if they split their time over there. I think this is the first time we've had two teams quarantining in WA at one time. So it's a little unique. And it's just an example of teams and clubs working together to share the load. Those two teams have been fantastic, Brisbane and Melbourne. And so they'll, leading into this weekend's games, they'll spend 3 days in one facility and swap over and 3 days in the other.
With Travis Old, the General Manager of Clubs and Broadcasting, crowds around 22 were hopeful. Everyone's sitting here listening. They want to get back and support their team. Doesn't hit home how much you miss it until you watch that game between Freo and Richmond over there and you hear the roar of the crowd. Mm. So what can we hope for? What's the best case scenario for round 22?
And I think that's the piece of work we're doing at the moment. So we're working really closely with the Victorian government on how we can start to rebuild crowds going into finals. Clearly, we need to be realistic about what that starting point is, but we think we've got enough measures in place to warrant the reintroduction of crowds sooner rather than later. How that ends up is really not our decision, but we're very supportive to get people back to the footy.
Hey, last night, our girls, the Matildas, were beaten by Sweden 1-0. As I welcome Mark Bosnich to the show, our all-time favourite. Bozza, good morning to you, my friend.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Oh, look, I'm well because I was working last night, so I didn't get to see it. Tim Watson came in this morning as fired up as I had. He wants to make a submission to the Swedish ambassador
protest
that they was borderline cheating last night. What's the story?
Well, He's got a point. He has got a point. Now we're all biased. I think we're all fired up. But it was definitely a touch and go one. But to be fair to the referee, she did blow very early. She obviously saw somebody being blocked, and she did blow very, very early. You know, with VAR, you know,
did she blow too early?
You know, if I was,
too early.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. With VAR, yeah. Maybe you would have let it go, but she was adamant. You know, she was absolutely adamant. The referee. I mean, there was a few people internationally on social media who were making the point that when you start that player in that offside position, generally it's to the block the opposition, and then he was making the point basically if you start that player like the Matildas did. And you get penalised, then you know you shouldn't be surprised. But look, from our point of view, I mean, it was, you know, like I said, from Tim, myself, and all of Australia, we all thought it was a goal, and that would have made a massive difference because it was right before half time.
That was a solid performance by the Matildas against Sweden.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. I don't think a lot of people before the tournament. You know, if you'd said to them we'd get to the semi-finals, they would have gone, okay, we'll take that. And Sweden, for me, have been the outstanding side of the tournament. So I think they can be very, very proud of the fact that they got to the semi-finals. It's the first time that they've got to the semi-finals in an international tournament. We obviously won the Asian Cup before, but in World Cups and Olympics, they've never got that far. And I thought it was a very good, you know, tournament for them, and now looking forward, now they obviously they got the World Cup coming up in 2023. There's another Asian Cup before that as well, but the big one is the World Cup, and I think that they've shown to themselves that they're not that far off.
Without going into great, great, great detail about the tactics last night, because Gary's eyes will glaze over. what were we doing last night?
I think Tony Gustafsson's done a very good job. Sometimes. You know, in any sport, and you both know that from your own sport as well, you've got to, you know, not sometimes really, if you want to be successful, you've got to cut your tactics to the players that you have. And especially in international football, there isn't a great deal of time for an international manager to work with those players. So I think, you know, taking those hard matches that he did as preparation to see exactly where we're at, getting beat and risking, you know, ruining the girls' confidence before the Olympics and then doing so well, I actually think he's done a very, very good job. A lot of people were disappointed. They thought that maybe we should have played a different way in terms of, you know, when we went 1-0 down. But, you know, I think the biggest thing that caught up with us was the fact that that we run out of gas a little bit. I think if you look at Sweden in the group, because they're already through, I mean, they could rest players against New Zealand. And I think that really told. And I thought that's why I was, you know, so disappointed that goal wasn't allowed. Because I thought whoever had scored first was going to go on and win the way I was looking at the girls and how they were shaping up.
Bozo, I was worried with the long ball style of the Matildas. I thought it isolated Kerr up front horribly.
Yeah, well, I guess so. It's just that the thing is, you know, Sweden defended very, very deep. Now, when you come up against a team who defends very, very deep, there are certain ways to try to break that down. One of them is to play long balls. One of them is to play shorter balls and spread out and to go through. You know, obviously Australia chose the latter, but I don't think you could really fault the tactics in terms of, you know, the overall spectrum and saying, oh, you know what, it was just the tactics. But they came up against a very, very good team. They were very unfortunate not to go 1-0 up. And like I said, in those big, big games and the tight games, and especially in our sport, it can really go either way.
Hey, Boz, I heard you talking about this the other day, and I found it fascinating. The penalty. Well, most things you say I find fascinating, but the penalty shootout, and you're explaining from a goal, a goalkeeper's perspective, what it was that you were watching from at the person taking the. Can you just explain it again?
Yeah, to simplify things down, from a goalkeeper's perspective, let's go backwards, let's start from right before the person takes the penalty. The non-kicking foot usually gives an idea where they're going to put the ball. So the non-kicking foot that they plant down, generally where that's pointing, that's where the ball's going to go. The gap between that non-kicking foot and the ball also tells a story. So it's a right footer coming to the ball, and the gap is quite significant normally. And the foot's pointing, normally it's going to go to the goalkeeper's right from a right footer. if the gap between the non-kicking foot and the ball is very close and it's pointing as well to the goalkeeper's left, normally goes to your left. The other thing is to look is the run-up. Normally, if they take a curled run-up as a right footer, so if you think you're facing it and they're taking a curled run-up, they usually shoot with the curl. If it's straight, they go usually with the straight. The best of them, but usually the best of them, they can, like I said the other day, they can get to the point where they can actually just look at the goalkeeper and not look at the ball and use their peripheral vision to look at the ball. So it's still in the hands of the shooter, but you can lower the odds as much as you possibly can.
What was your success rate over the journey?
I don't know. There was one year was like, I don't know, everything just went my way. I think it saved about, I think it was about 8 or 9 out of 13. That was including a shootout. I was lucky with penalties. Very, very lucky with penalties.
What about the stutter? You got to
have the luck to go the right way. And then your athleticism does come into it. But if you don't go the right way, you can be the most athletic people ever. You're going to let penalties in.
That was Mark Bosnich, the all-time great. What about the guy who stutters, Bozza, that comes in, he sort of half stutters.
I'm going to go to the right. Yeah, that's a good one. They've changed the rules over that over the years. You've got to have your run continuous now. Before you could stop and that, but now you can just stop, but you've got to keep your run continuous. Just like they changed the rules in terms of the goalkeeper has to have at least 1 foot on the line. So they're very difficult as well. But I've always thought that the guy that does stagger their run, I always think if you can hold yourself, I actually think it actually increases your odds as well. Remember, the ones who take their time, they like the goalkeeper to dive out the way so they can put it that side. The longer you hold and the more you can get the penalty taker to put his head down or her head down, the more it starts to swing in your favour. But you've really got to slow it down, just like one of those long-lens cameras, you keep your finger on it. You've got to slow it down like that.
Talking to one of the most knowledgeable, greatest goalkeepers of all time right across the world. Were you a champion high jumper when you were at school?
No, I wasn't a champion. I wouldn't say champion. I was more a 100-meter sprinter, long jumper. But I was okay. I couldn't completely master the Throsby flop. I'd do the normal one, you know, the one that was before the Throsby flop, because I had a really good spring. Mine was more long jump than 100-meter sprint.
What time for the 100, Boz, are we talking?
I was under 12 seconds as a kid, yeah.
Jeez.
And then as I got old, quick. As I got older, I would have think it was closer to 11, yeah.
You were wasted in the goals.
Well, that's what I keep telling everyone, but you know.
Hey, do we need to start worrying about Ange over there in Scotland?
Look, it's when you're at a big club, like I said, when you first arrived there, you always have to have that little worry in the back of your mind. Because at big clubs, you know, three losses on the trot is like, you know, people start saying things like, oh, you know, he won't last or this, that, and the other. But I just think that because of the state that Celtic were in, remember, they were 25 points off the pace last season against Rangers. And there was a lot of anger towards the board in terms of backing him. And because of the COVID situation, obviously the money for all sporting clubs around the world isn't there like it used to be. So I think there's an appreciation that there is. It's a bit of a mess at the moment. But the thing that that concerns me is not about Ange himself. I think he will get it right. Is the fact that if the board just turn around and sort of say, okay, to take the pressure off them, that they just turn around and get rid of the manager. Boards have done that before. Now I don't know the Celtic board very, very well. From what I'm reading and what I'm hearing, like I said, they're not in a particularly good place at the moment. They've obviously got that Jablonec to qualify for the Europa League. Which is the second tier European. There's the Champions League, which they missed out on, and Jablonec is on. It'll be Friday morning here. That's a big game, really big game, and you know, obviously starting off like they did in the league as well against Hearts, who just got promoted and getting beat, is not going to help their cause. They've got to get players, and he's got a lot of work to do there. Whether or not that's been said already, that he's been told before he comes that there won't be the funds available to get new players in, we don't know, but. I think the most important thing for him, like I said before, is that, you know, it is the result. We know he loves to play a beautiful brand of football, but coming back to what I said originally about the Matildas, if you haven't got the players to do it, you know, it's an uphill battle.